This is Pac-12 football.
Jordan Webb, pressure from the back. And down he goes in the arms of Big Will Sutton.
Barkley, oh, he got clobbered as well. This time Anthony Barr will record the sack.
Heisman hopefuls.
Caught! Marquise Lee! Touchdown, SC! 75 yards!
Mariota firing, lofting, and touchdown, the Black Mamba!
Championship caliber teams.
Hand off Taylor, left side, running, first down! Stanford's gonna win the Rose Bowl!
The Conference of Champions brings you the Pac-12 Network's football podcast. Here are your hosts, Mike Yam and Rick Neuheisel.
It is a rivalry week edition of the Pac-12 Network's football podcast. Mike Yam and Rick Neuheisel in the saddle with you.
D.D. Goodson.
Get ready to go. Some meaningful games that we have this coming weekend, and maybe the most significant one on the Pac-12 Network's Arizona State. You can catch it Saturday, 6:30 p.m. Pacific time. We're going to be in studio, ready to rock and roll.
If ASU's the Pac-12 owns prime time.
If Arizona State wins, they are hosting the Pac-12 championship game, one of the topics we will be discussing on Pac-12 Football Weekly Wednesday night, 6 p.m. Pacific.
Multiple re-airs.
Is how much home field advantage can play a factor in a game against Stanford. I don't want to steal the thunder of what we're doing later in this show. And not to even get on a tangent here, but Jake Fisher, got an opportunity to speak with him yesterday. He will be joining us a little bit later. We'll get you that interview on the podcast. Adam Kramer from Bleacher Report once again in his bi-weekly spot. The one thing we just finished up our meeting for Football Weekly tonight, and there was something interesting that you said that I don't think anyone, I would say most people, are a very small percentage of the population know exactly what you're talking about and have ever been privy to these types of conversations and been in these types of meetings. But you had said when NFL teams are going over film and they're going to look at particular moments, there's one play, and you said that it's you'd put it on pause, go and get 15 guys. They'd come into the room and go and watch this. Explain to me why Leonard Williams is such a special guy, because I think for some, we understand how talented he is, but to me, that resonated because I'm going, he's that good where you're going to pause the tape when you're watching? Like, what did you see? What have you seen from him?
It's a unique play, and Leonard Williams, the defensive tackle for USC, playing against Arizona State. There's a play where Taylor Kelly breaks through the line of scrimmage and is off on a scamper. Probably ends up with a 15 to 25 yard run, okay? And Leonard Williams is not at the point of attack, so he doesn't have a chance to make the play at the line of scrimmage, but he ends up and takes off in pursuit. And the way he runs in that clip is you can't take your eyes off it. If you have an eye for this sort of thing. And I said, that's where the NFL scouts would pause it and go get guys and say, come and watch this guy on this play.
How often does that happen? When you're with the Ravens and you're going over film, how often do you say,
there are some super athletes out there that do unique things. Shaq Richardson, the play that he makes against Oregon by flipping the ball back into the field of play for Scooby Wright to make the interception, that is a play where you're going to go get somebody. Check this play out. But it's usually for feats of athleticism that are beyond the norm. I mean, it isn't because a guy runs 4.4 as opposed to 4.5, or it's a unique superhuman act that, and because of the dimensions of a guy like Leonard Williams, who stands probably 6'4" or 6'5", and weighs, you know, right at 300 pounds, for him to turn off and run and chase Taylor Kelly down and give the effort as he dives to get his heel is unique for a guy in the trenches who, is basically getting beat up on an every down basis, or at least beating somebody up on an every down basis.
Which leads me to one of the more significant rivalries that we have in the Pac-12. You're going to be able to see USC and UCLA go head-to-head. You know exactly how significant this rivalry is. Is there a memory, not so much about this game in particular, but going back to your time playing or coaching in this rivalry, is there something that stands out to you?
Absolutely. We all remember the games that we played in more than any other. And my senior year, 1983, we needed to beat USC, and we needed Washington State to help us by beating Washington to get to the Rose Bowl. And we were behind 10-6 at halftime, and we went in and found out that Washington State had done just that. They'd beaten Washington. So now if we can go out and win the second half, we we go to the granddaddy of them all, and we went out and beat SC 27-17, outscored 21 points in the first drive of the third quarter. I went right down the field. We went right down the field, and I hit Carl Durrell, who ironically was my predecessor as the head coach at UCLA. I hit him for a touchdown in the corner of the end zone. And right as I was letting go of the ball, Jack Del Rio, who now is the acting head coach at Denver Broncos, hit me. And I remember him saying, you know, some expletives in the pile. And I just looked up and I said, "Scoreboard, baby." And, you know, the game was on. We down 10-6. Now it's 13-10. And we went on a march at the end of the game where we consumed probably 8.5 minutes of possession time. And I remember enjoying watching that clock go down to one every time I'd snap it and getting first downs by the length of a football. And knowing as the clock ran off, so did their hopes for winning, and meant that we were going to get to go back to Pasadena, which we had had the time of our lives the year before in beating Michigan in the Rose Bowl in the 83 Rose Bowl, 82 season. And fortunately, we were able to go again, play against Illinois.
What year were you?
I was senior that year.
That was your senior year. Mm-hmm. You just brought up something that resonates to me, because we were watching UCLA this past weekend against Arizona State, and you just said to me, hey, there was nothing better than seeing that clock just tick-tock those seconds away. And I'm curious if that is something that for you, I mean, you have a knack for this, and obviously, you know, I don't know if coaching was something that when you were even playing, you thought, hey, I would want to do this. But you either get it or you don't. And UCLA, you pointed this out on the post-game show on Saturday night. State Farm postgame report, after all the action, most comprehensive coverage of the Pac-12 conference you can find. And you had said right before halftime, they gave up the 7 points based off of the fact that Arizona State was able to capitalize in a close football game. But you kept pointing. And as this is unfolding and we're watching this game, you're going nuts in our touchdown room saying, you got it. You got to take more time. You got to take more time. Is that something that is for you? Was that a skill or something that you knew about clock management prior to your senior, or something that you just learn over your time?
It's a fascinating topic for me, and it's something that I've studied for a long time. But I had a coach by the name of Homer Smith that was really good at teaching clock offense. And basically, Mike, it's a formula. It's how to divide what you need in terms of yards, because we know before the drive starts whether or not we need a touchdown or a field goal. At the end of a first half, you always divide it in terms of making your assessment by saying, I need a field goal. You're trying to get some points before the end of half. But you always know what your yardage is, and then you divide it into the time left. And you for simplicity's sake, you say every play is worth 10 seconds. And so if you've got the ball with a minute 20 left on your own 20, okay, that means you have 80 seconds for 80 yards, 10 seconds play, you've got 8 plays, right? So 8 plays to go down the field, 80 yards, means you need 10 yards a play, meaning that you can call plays that are much more high percentage, not needing, I used to call them control plays and chunk plays. Control play, by definition, is a ball that you're going to catch somewhere between 10 yards and less, and you can run for the other yards that you don't, and you're going to end up moving the clock. Now, it averages out. Sometimes those gains are 6 yards, sometimes those gains are 12, 13. But somewhere around, you're going to end up around 10 yards in terms of the math. And you're doing this math equation in your head every play, okay? Then you figure out if you needed a touchdown. If you needed a field goal, I always said, let's plan on getting it to the 20. So it's a 37-yard field goal. Sometimes you don't get that far, but that's what you're trying to get done. So now it's 60 yards, okay? That is all that you needed to have using the same line of departure, the 20-yard line. And so you can manage that. So I see it every time I watch college football, people starting clock drives by throwing deep, trying to get a big chunk. It's a low percentage plays. Now, if I change the formula and say we have 40 seconds, and UCLA left 47 seconds on the clock for ASU. And if they started by saying, okay, we're going to try to get a field goal, they needed to get to the 30-yard line for a long field goal opportunity for their young, very talented kicker in Zane Gonzalez. So they get the ball on the 25 or wherever it was that they got it. You only need 25 and 20, 45 yards, 47 seconds left on the clock. That's easy.
Yeah.
And that's why you can't leave that much. And yet Arizona State was able to hit some big plays down the field, ultimately culminated with the touchdown to
Jalen Strong
that basically were the 7 points, the difference in the ballgame. And by not understanding the math that's associated with clock offense, and it's true of professional football as well, although it's a little easier clock drives in college football because the clock stops after first downs. But not understanding that, you're just leaving it up to chance that good things will happen to you. And unfortunately for the Bruins in this regard, they didn't.
Everyone talks about rivalries and saying you don't need extra motivation. USC is motivated, and every team has this. I mean, ASU, for example, they win, they get to host the Pac-12 championship game. USC, they win. The thought is it'd be really hard to not hire Ed Orgeron as the full-time head coach if USC is able to take out UCLA and run this table like they've been able to. With that in mind, are those at all even relevant? I mean, I've heard bulletin board material. I mean, geez, when you get out onto the field, how much are things like that in the minds of players?
Well, we heard it up close and personal when Buck Allen was interviewed in the post game by Drea. You know, she asked him, "Hey, what was your mindset going?" He said, "We need to keep winning for Coach O." I mean, it wasn't alluded to. It wasn't read between the lines kind of stuff. It was direct. These kids want Ed Orgeron to be their head coach. They love playing for him. They feel a kinship. And they can't wait to hoist him up on their shoulders, not only because of victory, but because he's the new man. And because of that, that puts some extra pressure on the guy making the choice, in this case, Pat Hayden, the athletic director. But I think Pat Hayden has enough cachet as the guy in charge at USC, given his intelligence, his you know, leadership ability, and his historical position amongst the elite at USC, that they'll trust whatever Pat says. I don't think he can make this choice based on what the kids who are excited about hamburgers and cookies and all that stuff. And yet, I think it would also be just as ridiculous for Pat not to pay attention to what's happened there. And so it has been fun to watch from an outsider's standpoint what is possible when everybody's on the same page. And that is certainly the case right now at USC.
Adam Kramer from the Bleacher Report, we're going to talk to him about the next head coach at USC and who that's going to be. That's coming up in about 15 minutes' time. But this game, USC and UCLA, comes down to what factor?
Well, USC has a very, very good defensive front. Leonard Williams, we spoke about. George Uko is a fabulous player. Maybe the most valuable player in their defense is a kid by the name of Devon Kennard, who, you know, wasn't available to them last year. He's kind of a heart and soul type of player, gives great leadership, and also is great edge pressure. You know, with Morgan Breslin down, he's really important. Hayes Pollard at linebacker is a good, really good football player, very instinctive. Those guys are going to put a lot of pressure on that very inexperienced UCLA front.
Yeah,
you know, we saw Simon Goins go down again last week. So you're going to start probably three freshmen on that front, and that's tough sledding against the likes of these guys that are going to put on the Trojan uniform. So it's incumbent upon UCLA and Noel Mazzone, their offensive coordinator, to come up with a plan that allows Brett Hundley to get the ball out of his hands. I would guess that Miles Jack will go back to playing defense. Because with Cody Kessler at quarterback, he's more of a stationary target. You're going to want pressure. You're certainly going to get it from Anthony Barr on one side. If you can add Miles Jack to the other side, you can combat that pass rush that you're going to see from USC and make the field position relatively equal there. But it's critical that Brett Hundley doesn't get sacked. It's critical that he doesn't sit back there and stare at the same target, which unfortunately has been his habit here of late. And take sacks. 9 times sacked by Arizona State in a game where you lose by 5 points. You just can't afford that. You've got to be able to turn the ball over. You got to make plays. Turn the chains. Make and stay on the field. I think they were 3 of 12 on third down last week. That's got to be a better number. And if they do, they certainly have the weapons to be successful once they get into the SC secondary. Shaq Evans is playing terrific football. I think there's a number of kids in the receiving corps at UCLA that can make plays, but Hundley's got to have time to set his feet, and then he's got to be quick in recognizing coverage and get the ball out of his hands.
Rick, tragedy aside, your toughest moment as a head football coach?
Toughest moment as a head football coach? Well, getting the news that I was no longer the head football
coach. Besides, that's no employment. That's no fun. And here's the reason why I ask, because Oregon and Oregon State are playing in the Civil War later this week. And Mark Helfrich, this is his first time as a head football coach. And I have to think, when they came off that loss against Stanford, you say, hey, this is what we learn. This is the time we find out what kind of coach Mark Helfrich is. Now, we saw what happened this past week against Arizona. And I guess the reason why I ask you is there something to be learned from maybe your experiences as a head football coach in trying times that maybe that we can take away with Mark Helfrich as he's staring down a rivalry game coming off a loss that was, let's call it what it was. I mean, that was a massive upset.
You know, when you go from being there, first of all, there's no book that says head coaching 101 and that you read it. And now you've got all the answers. You've got to learn the answers. And here's what happened to Mark Helfrich last week. Okay. He felt like because they had beaten Utah after the disappointment of the loss against Stanford, that it was behind him, and they were going to continue to fight and hope for good things by Stanford, hope that they'd lose. Well, all of a sudden, SC deals them that card and allows them to take back control of their fate with respect to winning the conference. And I don't think it ever crossed his mind that there would be players who would say, we don't want to play in a Rose Bowl. And yet, that's exactly what happened. And when it happened, his instincts now have to say one of two things. One, I'm not going to react to it, and I'm going to just trust the leadership of this football team to get ready to play. Or two, I'm going to nip this in the bud and make sure these guys understand just how important it is to play our best football.
Can you do that with college kids?
Absolutely. But you can do whatever you want with college kids as long as it's with conviction.
Okay.
You have to be able to impart what's important and what's not important. And it doesn't necessarily always mean in a group setting. Sometimes it's one-on-one meetings with every guy on your team so that they understand and you can get a sense as to how they feel. Because I go back to what Urban Meyer did at Ohio State when one of his players said that we could wipe the table with some of these teams that were ranked ahead of him. Urban Meyer immediately stood up and said, no, I'm not going to have that, and told that guy he's not going to be involved in the press. And yet when Josh Huff and DeAnthony Thomas say what they said, whether it was taken out of context or not, there was no reaction from Mark Helfrich, at least publicly. Now, later there was, where he said it was taken out of context and you know, they shouldn't have said what they said. But the point of the matter is that showed there was a little leak in terms of their focus and their concentration, that they still didn't think that the stakes were such that it deserved their full attention. And it showed in their play. You cannot put on the film against Arizona and say that Oregon was at full tilt in terms of their concentration. Balls on the ground, tackles missed. It just wasn't the same Oregon team that we've all come to know and appreciate, because we have been witness to one of the great programs in college football here of the last 4 years.
Harder when it's your stars.
And so now Mark Helfrich in his first year probably is not taking his team to a BCS game. They've been on a four-year run of BCS games, one time to the title game against Auburn, two Rose Bowls and a Fiesta Bowl last year in a victory over Kansas State. Those all belong to Chip Kelly. So Mark Helfrich has to find a way now to stamp Mark Helfrich. And this is a great learning. Now, he might think he didn't learn anything. Maybe Neuheisel's talking smoke and he doesn't need to pay any attention to this. But somehow, some way, it's going to be on him to get this team to understand the importance and the significance of a Civil War. And I think on the other side of the tracks, Mike Riley's got to do the same, because that was a very disappointing effort by the Oregon State program a week ago against Washington, playing against a quarterback that had never started a game, a guy that you can't think is going to throw the ball a lot, and you give up over 500 yards rushing. That speaks to something deeper than talent.
69 points.
Something deeper than talent, and therein lies Mike Riley's challenge to find out what it is. Why are we not getting what you're capable of giving? And so to me, though, that game is going to be a coaching game. And I think I know a bunch of guys on both of those staffs, and I know how much they love this game and appreciate the game and respect the game. And I know that to be true about Mark Helfrich and certainly Mike Riley. I think the coaching job in this game is going to be one to, for the ages, in terms of digging into the individuals involved and saying, boys, we got to play. Because if they don't get that out of them, there's something deeper wrong at those two institutions.
Love rivalry matchups. The significant one that means something, the Territorial Cup, Saturday, 6:30 p.m. Pacific here on the Pac-12 Networks. Yesterday, I got an opportunity to speak with Jake Fisher. Before we even started talking about the game against Arizona State, had to go back to the matchup against Oregon, and I asked him what it was like to win against a Ducks team that, at least on paper, appeared to be overwhelming.
I mean, it was huge to get a victory like that. We approach every game like we're going to win. We think we can hang with anybody in the country. And, you know, we showed it on Saturday. And, you know, the way we approached it was, it doesn't matter if the people outside of the locker room don't believe in us. As long as, you know, our band of brothers, we all come together and we believe as one, and we can go out and beat anybody.
What does it say about the team that after two straight losses, and let's just call it what it is, you guys were upset by Washington State 2 weeks ago? I mean, not to say that anyone can't win, and you guys showed that against Oregon, but I think most people would have said, hey, Wildcats at home against the Cougars team, that's advantage Arizona. What does it say about the leadership on your team that after those two losses, you were able to rebound and get a win against Oregon?
Well, it says a lot. You know, we felt that we let a couple games slide. We felt like we should have won both. And, you know, we didn't. So we have a 24-hour rule. Doesn't matter what happened, you know, 24 hours prior. After those 24 hours, we move on. And whether it's a win or a loss, we start preparing for the next opponent. And, you know, that's what we did. And, you know, there was a ton of intensity at practice that next week. Everyone, you know, was really upset about the last couple weeks. And, you know, we went out and just tried to play our best game.
Does Rich Rodriguez follow that 24-hour rule? Something tells me that maybe during the week for Oregon, Washington State popped up a couple times.
No, he follows it very well. And, you know, he's the one that, you know, tells us to follow the 24-hour rule. And, you know, he does it too. So, you know, we move forward. He said, you know, obviously it was a disappointing loss. But he said, we got to move forward like we're going to beat this next team. We believed from the get-go, and it showed on the field.
Jake, I have said this many times on this show that your coach, Rich Rodriguez, might be the most entertaining coach in the conference. He is a phenomenal storyteller. He has shared a lot of stories in the short time that I've got to spend with him. What's he like inside the locker room after the win against Oregon?
I mean, he's live. after the win, he was definitely excited. And, you know, his message to us was, you know, if we come together as one team and as one unit, and we have the same belief going towards the same goals, anything could happen.
Was there anything fun that was different maybe that week heading into the Oregon game that wasn't there those previous 2 weeks?
Well, I mean, the intensity was still there. The only thing we did different was, you know, we had a bunch of stuff for our seniors who were obviously going to play their last game. So, you know, a lot of the freshmen, after we broke, they would carry the seniors off the field. We had an introduction where we all went in the dugout. And then Matt Dudek, you know, he went on the loudspeaker and he would introduce us. We would all come out and they made a tunnel for us. All the younger guys did. And, you know, we kind of ran out through the tunnel and just stuff like that. It was pretty fun.
What's that like for you? I mean, you've been with this program, you're a senior, you're a local guy, you grew up in the area. I mean, that's got to be, maybe it was overwhelming for you, was it?
After the game, it was. I try not to worry about that kind of stuff until after the game. And, you know, after the game, I, you know, let out a few tears. But before that, you know, I kept it all business. And, you know, I just try to go out and do my best and lead my team to victory.
Kadeem Carey rushed for over 200 yards and 4 touchdowns. He outrushed and outscored Oregon as a team. I mean, the numbers are ridiculous. The records that he is setting at Arizona. We made the case on right after the game here on the Pac-12 Networks that Kadeem Carey's got to be in the conversation right now for the Heisman. Make the case for your running back.
Kadeem is the best running back in the country. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. You know, he carries most of the load for our offense. And, you know, our offensive line does a great job. And this man, you can't tackle him with one guy. You know, he gets off more tackles than I've seen. Best running back I've ever seen. It's great going against him in practice because it gives us practice. And, you know, just look for him to do big things. You know, he's going to make it to the next level. And the thing is, he's a great team guy. He does everything that he possibly can to help lead our team to victory. And, you know, he's become a huge vocal leader as well. So not only is he the best running back in the country, but he's a great leader, a great friend, very charismatic, and he does whatever it takes to, you know, get a W.
What would your response be to the critics who say that Kadeem Carey, who had some off-the-field issues, isn't deserving of an award like that because of some of those things?
Well, he got a bad rep for that. It blew up. It, you know, that doesn't show who he is at all. You know, like I said, he's a great friend. He's very charismatic, friendly. You know, he works as hard as he possibly can. You know, he's in there getting extra lifts in every other day. Works hard at practice. You know, you can talk to him about anything. And, you know, he always has a huge smile on his face. So, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, people think that's going to hinder him. But, you know, he's kind of shown through it. He sat out the first game, came back, and, you know, it just shows that he's willing to go ahead and, you know, just deal with that kind of stuff. But he does it in a positive way. He wanted to come back and show everybody that he's still a great person, you know, as well as a player, and I think he's done that.
You mentioned Kadeem in practice, and I got to think that going up against some of the running backs of the Pac-12 conference, I mean, this is an elite conference for skill players, and the running backs are fantastic as well. What's it like to take a hit from Kadeem Carey? Because when we watch him, the other teams on defense, it seems like he's always dragging one or two or even three guys along with him.
Well, we really weren't allowed to hit him during camp. But, you know, he's wild, man. It's hard to square him up just because, you know, he has such great leverage. If you try to, you know, if you try to boom him, he'll just roll right off of you. And, I mean, it's hard. You know, we would have to have a couple guys get to the ball as well, you know, when we were playing against him. So, you know, he's a hoss.
This weekend on the Pac-12 networks at 6:30, it's your Wildcats matching up against Arizona State. It's the Territorial Cup. All eyes are going to be on this one. It's probably the best game in the conference when you consider what's at stake. If Arizona State wins this football game, they get to host the Pac-12 championship. And I know that there would be no better feeling in the world to not only beat them, but to not allow that to happen. Is there extra juice, more juice, because of what's on the line for them in this game?
Well, I mean, there's always there's always extra motivation when you're playing against your rival. And, you know, we're just going to approach it like it's a rivalry game. You know, we're going to prepare like we're going to win. We're going to go out and play as hard as we possibly can. And if we do that, I think everything else will take care of itself.
Jake, I mentioned that you're a senior. You're finishing up your career. When you look back at your time at Arizona, what will stand out to you?
You know, there's a couple games that'll stand out. You know, definitely the rivalry games, the bowl games, the wins we've had over top 10 teams, but hopefully the best is yet to come.
What would going out with a win in the Territorial Cup, at least during the regular season, what would that mean for you?
I mean, it would mean a lot. Definitely to be able to look back and, you know, sit in the last game against a rival, we got the W. But, you know, that's all talk. We're going to go prepare as hard as we possibly can and, you know, go out and play the game.
All right, well, best of luck to you this coming weekend. Jake, really appreciate you giving us a few minutes here, and good luck on Saturday. We're going to be watching.
Thank you very much.
So you can understand from a senior's perspective, and it's good to talk to Jake Fisher yesterday, what it's like and what it would mean to him to take this Territorial Cup. You said something to me earlier that both of these teams are coming in at the pinnacle of their confidence on the season, which
and in the current reigns of the two respective head coaches. This is the high water mark for Rich Rod. It's the high water mark for Todd Graham with respect to the leadership of their programs. I think if you talk to their constituencies, they would both say, hey, we got the right guy. We can't wait for next year, blah, blah, blah.
This game based off of that, a week ago, you would have said to me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you would have said, hey, Arizona State is at least on paper, got a they're the favorite. They're the team that you would expect to win. Can you say that based off of what we saw Arizona do against Oregon?
Well, I still think Arizona State, from a talent standpoint, is a little bit ahead of Arizona. But what it what happened last week in Tucson with that win over Oregon, just as what happened in Tempe when Washington came to town, is Arizona set a standard for itself, especially defensively, with how hard they played and their attention to detail as a defense. And to play less than that would be unacceptable to those kids that it's really important to, and it's really important to everybody in this kind of a game, especially when you're feeling good about yourself, as both programs are. Arizona State against Washington, by limiting Washington to minus 5 yards rushing, even though Bishop Sankey was in the backfield holding him to 22 yards, that set a new standard for Sun Devil rush defense. You know, remember, Wisconsin went for over 200. SC went for over 200. Yeah. Stanford went for over 200. So they were not as advertised. And yet in that game, they became the Sun Devil defense. And to me, that's why they beat UCLA, that Sun Devil defense. You know, 9 sacks, 10 tackles for loss, a pick six by Carl Bradford. Those things all played huge dividends in the Sun Devil victory that clinched the South Division crown. Arizona comes into this with similar now experience, having beaten the top dogs in the Pac-12 for a long time in Oregon. I know Stanford would say that they're the top dogs by virtue of their North Division
ask
crown.
Ask USC what they think about their team.
And my point is, it's you beat a top team, you know, like Oregon, it gives you a shot in the arm from a confidence standpoint. And it also, from the competitive side of the athlete, I want more. I want more of this. And so here's the stage to get more of it against their in-state rival, the Sun Devils. So I think you're going to see a fantastic ball game where, you know, the highlight film's going to be full. There'll be lots of big plays because kids will be that hyped up to play.
More on some of these rivalry matchups, not to mention what happened this past weekend. Adam Kramer, the lead college football writer for the Bleacher Report, good enough to stop by with us the other day. Got an opportunity to speak with him. I asked him how surprised he was that the Wildcats even won this past week.
I thought that they could keep it close, that, you know, offensively they'd have enough with their running game to make things interesting. The weeks prior to that were just back-and-forth results, though, which told me maybe they weren't up for it. And not only the upset, it's how they do it. I mean, that game wasn't even close. The results weren't even close. It was strange, you know, just taking it nationally to see Baylor and Oregon, these sort of video game offenses that we've been talking about all year, and for good reason, by the way, just looking at them and watching them just not being able to function within a few hours of each other. It was different, and it was certainly unexpected.
Rick has talked about this. We've talked about it, obviously, on this podcast and over the weekend on some of our studio shows about the lack of respect and the fact that Oregon, you know, the football gods maybe came down on them pretty hard after the comments from DeAnthony Thomas and Josh Huff. Do you think that they overlooked this opponent? Is there that sense? Because to watch Kadeem Carey outrush and outscore Oregon as a team, to me is, and he's a great guy, a great running back. Yeah, I think you'd make the case that he should be in the Heisman picture. But Oregon is so prolific. You use the analogy video game type offense. What happened to them in this football game?
It's just, you know, breakdowns on a variety of fronts. And again, similar with Baylor. When the offense isn't going, the defense did not have it at the right time. And that's not something you can necessarily expect or handicap. It just happened. So I think the most surprising thing to me, offensively. Defensively, we know this team is good and it's much better, but you know it's going to give up points, especially to a running back like this. And an offense that can move the football, you'd think they'd be able to stop them a little bit. But against Stanford, maybe that was sort of weakening the wall, so to speak, and now Arizona just ran right through it, although Stanford pretty much ran right through it as well. So to me, it's just the most surprising thing is offensively what they weren't able to do. We've heard a lot about Marcus Mariota's health. over the past few weeks, whether it be the knee and now, of course, dealing with his head. Is that factoring in? De'Anthony Thomas really hasn't been able to get going. And you coincide that with the comments, of course. It's just bad timing. Games like this happen to teams. We're just not used to seeing it happen with Oregon. And obviously with a new head coach, all of a sudden we have to step back and sort of reshape our expectations for that team, because that kind of performance, again, with what we've seen of the Ducks recently, it just hasn't happened.
Glad you brought up Marcus Mariota's head, the concussion protocol. He's passed all the tests, expected to play on Friday night against Oregon State in the Civil War. I mentioned Kadeem Carey's name. Where is he in your Heisman list? Is he in the top two, top three? Because we've talked about this, sort of hard to handicap this year's race.
It's very difficult. And obviously, with Jameis Winston's situation requiring patience and time, I think we're left wondering the evaluation process beyond that. I think he's very much in the mix. You can make a case for him at number two. For me, he's in my top five. I look at this award a little bit differently. I think Jordan Lynch is a guy that's not getting enough respect from Northern Illinois. I think Derek Carr, obviously, as well at quarterback. But when you look at what Kadeem Carey has done, not going to probably match his numbers from a year ago, but that's just how ridiculous they were. They're still ridiculous this year, and you just see how much he does for that offense. I think you can make a great case for him as a Heisman winner in a year where it's still uncertain this late, which is a rarity. He's still very much in the mix.
You said you could make an argument he might be two. Just for clarification purposes, McCarron's one then? Because it's hard to pick out. Depending on who you ask, they might have a different guy in that top spot. Is McCarron one for you?
I think I still have Jameis Winston at one.
Wow. Okay, I'm glad I asked.
With the ability to back out of that if need be, for obvious reasons, of course. And this is a difficult decision to make for a lot of people. The timing is not great. The timing for this, of course, is not great for any time. But in terms of the football-related items, which are real and which are coming up, for me, until we learn more, he's at number one, although I'm writing that in pencil. I think Agent McCarron is a very interesting case, but numbers-wise, to me, his influence on that team, and I made a case for this week, I think C.J. Mosley is the most impactful player on that team at linebacker. If I'm voting for a Heisman, and I know that's a little bit away from the norm, I'd give it to him. So to me, it's not necessarily just about the quarterbacks and the programs, but the guys that you watch and you say, there is a Heisman. Mosley is that guy. Kadeem Carey is that guy. There are a handful of them out there, and there are a bunch of names right now warranting consideration.
You're actually the perfect guy to ask, because I think most people who are listening to this podcast are Pac-12 fans for their respective teams. And Kadeem Carey, we usually throw out the term that he's the best running back in the country. Bishop Sankey, I think, is in that conversation. But Andre Williams at Boston College, fans on the West Coast, they might not be all that familiar with what the BC running back has been able to accomplish. Over 2,000 yards already on the season is what we've seen from him. He is that team's weapon. How does Williams compare to Carey in your mind?
I think it's somewhat similar in a sense that offensively, these are your guys. The numbers are freakish. If you look at the past three games, and I wrote this in my column, it looks like a science experiment because of all the yards, all the production. I think the one case against him, his two toughest games in Clemson and USC, he did not run well. Now, it's difficult for running backs. Literally, he is the only guy. So there, you can put as many guys up there, and he's been able to run through them or pass them in most cases. But unbelievable season, a season so good that even though his team, I don't want to say they're bad, but they're not great. And of course, to win this award, usually you can't win a whole lot of games. We'd have to break that norm. But you just watch the way he plays. It's 230-pound running backs are not supposed to move like that. Very much in the conversation. If you're having me pick right now between him and Carey, I'd probably lean towards Carey, although it's very close.
Well,
very close. Right now, neck and neck. And thankfully, we have a little bit more football to watch.
If you mention common opponents, and USC is the common opponent between both of those teams, Arizona mm-hmm. and Boston College, USC carry 21 carries, 138 yards, and Williams in the matchup against USC, 17 carries for 38 yards. Now, keep in mind, he's over 2,000 yards, and he had a game where he had 38. So that goes to show you how fantastic he's been in pretty much every other game so far this season. So if anyone asks you, Adam, need some ammo for carry, that's at least one nugget you can use.
And he's just a freak, by the way. I mean, he is just – both these running backs are unique in styles and both a lot of fun to watch. But, my goodness, seeing a guy of that size, if you're looking for good YouTube footage, go back to his game against Clemson where he literally just runs through a defender. That's about as good of a play as you'll see a running back make all year.
Well, on Saturday here on the Pac-12 Networks, Arizona State, 6:30 p.m. Pacific. It's the Territorial Cup. It's significant. It might be the most significant game in the conference this coming weekend when you consider that if Arizona State wins, they get home field advantage in the Pac-12 championship game against Stanford. I saw on Bleacher Report, Adam, you were talking about bowl projections. I'm not going to say, because I don't want anyone to get angry with you, which team you had matching up against Ohio State. You know what? I'll throw you under the bus. You had Stanford there. That's who you project out. And I don't want to say, I think some would argue that they would be the favorite in that potential matchup. But let's just say for argument's sake, Stanford or ASU, how would those teams match up against an Ohio State team that has not lost since Urban Meyer's taken over?
I think obviously unique styles, and I think both would match up well. I think when you look at Ohio State, which reminds me a bit of Arizona State in the combination of finesse and power, when need be, and Braxton Miller and Carlos Hyde, the quarterback running back combination, it's a really difficult thing to key up against because, again, you've got a 235-pound back and a quarterback that can beat you in so many ways. But when you look at Stanford and Arizona State, certainly the physicality of both fronts, both defensive fronts, I think is an enormous trait against a team like Ohio State that's going to try and do some creative things with Urban Meyer. I think that will help when you have big bodies up front. We saw that against Oregon. We've seen Arizona State do it against a variety of teams. And I think, you know, defensively they match up great. And then offensively, obviously, two different ways to attack. Arizona State will both teams, truly, will want to throw the ball and also sprinkle in some run. If you would like to pinpoint a weakness for Ohio State, to me, it's still the secondary. It's been better. But when you watch a team like Illinois throw the ball a little bit, I think that's something that both teams would try to expose. And quite frankly, I think that's something with the personnel they have that they could have some success with.
Speaking of Stanford and their matchup with Notre Dame, at least, I'm thinking back to what happened last year. And at least for Cardinal fans, they get this game at home. Notre Dame's not as good as everyone seems to think they are they? 25th ranked team in the country. Do they deserve that?
They've beaten a fair amount of top 25 teams. And so, you know, it's hard. It's a hard team to evaluate. I watch them. I usually am covering them weekly now. And it's sort of Jekyll and Hyde. As weird as it sounds, Tommy Reese has actually been pretty good for them. They found some weapons at running back throughout the year. Wide receivers with guys like DeVaris Daniels, and you know they can make things happen. Defensively, however, is where this team has really regressed, not been nearly as good. I think they're capable. I actually think offensively they can probably get some points, but going up against a team like Stanford that's probably just going to wear them down and just run the ball over and over, and it's not something they've been great against, I think that's probably going to end up being the difference in this game.
All right, I don't want to necessarily ask for your breakdown against USC and UCLA, but I do want to get your take on the question that I'm sure you've been asked, I don't know, about a million times over the last couple of weeks. you know where I'm going. Let's say USC wins this football game, the players have rallied. They have made it a point to say that they want Ed Orgeron to be their guy, that he should be that guy. How likely is it that he would become the head football coach at USC if they beat UCLA?
Well, let me just say this. I've made the case for Edo. If he wins this game, how do you not keep him? Like, how do you justify removing this guy given what he's done? Me personally, I think he's the guy. I'm campaigning for him to begin with. Now, what will Pat Hayden do? He's a brilliant individual. He's obviously mentioned that he's a part of this race. He's also a guy that's certainly been shopping around, you know, talking about maybe interviews with Jack Del Rio, Kevin Sumlin's name has come up, all intriguing guys. For me, you can purchase these coaches. You can offer them enormous sums of money. We've heard $6 million a year floated around in the past few weeks. Finding the right fit at a school is so undervalued, and you can't buy fit. I think that's what, you know, Eddie O has brought to them from a, you know, an emotional standpoint and just from a production standpoint. And now we see some recruiting impacts trickle in. You know, they're flipping a recruit from Alabama in the past few weeks. So, to me, if he wins this game, I don't know how you possibly tell him he cannot be the coach after what he's done. Will that be the case? I think Pat Hayden has a very difficult decision on his hands.
How much, though, do you think you're riding on momentum and the emotion of this decision? I mean, do you think Pat Hayden I'm sure he will, but I almost feel like you have to step back and say, hey, in the short term, maybe this clearly was what USC needed in the short term. How can you make the case right now? And I guess I'm asking you to, how do you make the case for him to be the long-term answer? Have you seen enough? Is this sample size enough for you to say, you know what, he not only deserves it, but he can flourish in this role?
I think you're bringing up a great point of not getting swept up in the excitement that is surrounding him. With that said, perception of a head coach in a time where social media is flourishing, in acceptance, whether this is a good or bad hire, you know, is a part of it. Perception is reality. So while you don't want to get swept up in this, you can't ignore the fact that this school, the city, the players, the fans are embracing this guy. I know that sounds weird. And it's not supposed to be a fanboy angle, but a lot of that trickles into recruiting, trickles into energy. It's more than just X's and O's. Now, so much has been made of his tenure at Ole Miss, which was nothing short of a disaster, albeit one where he recruited quite well. He's tackled that full circle, said he's learned from it. Are we going to see that again? I don't think so. I think he's certainly meshed here. He's learned from that situation. You don't know long-term how any of these coaches are going to be. But you know what you have right now seems to be working, and it's so hard to find that for me it's a difficult move to change, because what you do, even if you bring in a coach like Kevin Sumlin, who is fantastic, you're not guaranteed that you're going to see any sort of run quite like this in quite some time.
That's a good point. Adam Kramer, you can check out his stuff. Bleacher Report, he's the lead college football writer. Adam, always appreciate you stopping by with us here on the podcast.
Thank you, my friend. Have a good one.
Well, it is certainly interesting to see how that matchup is going to play out and the effect that it could have on Coach O and USC. Your first head coaching job, fond memories that I know you have, and I learned about a lot of those memories during our training camp tour. But when you were with Colorado, there were some great times, and they have gone on some hard times recently. However, this season, things have turned around. You'll be able to catch those Buffs against the Utes, 11 a.m. Pacific this Saturday. Pregame show starts at 10 a.m. You and Yogi Roth, who's gonna be hosting with us tonight on Pac-12 Football Weekly. I got to do it again. 6 p.m. Pacific.
Multiple rears.
You guys both like Colorado in this game.
I think Colorado comes into this game feeling really good about themselves. That does not mean that Kyle Whittingham can't get his Utes to rise up and play their last home game, especially for those seniors. Guys like Trevor Riley, I know, are going to be excited to play. Yeah. But I like the way Colorado comes into this game, and I think if they could find a way to win – their fifth game, it would be a huge, huge shot in the arm for their program as it heads into recruiting. I know one short of a bowl berth, but still much better than I think most people anticipated from the program in year one under Mike McIntyre. But I think this program's on the right path. I really do. And for Utah, you know, shoot, this has been a really disappointing season, because it wasn't so long ago we were talking about what a great win over Stanford.
Yeah.
And we saw the locker room scene after, where Kyle Whittingham says, hey, I know we were talking about bowls, we can go a lot further than that. And they've been winless since. And it's a head scratcher for everybody who follows the Utah program. But it's really not. When the quarterback play is inconsistent, it's really difficult to win, especially in as a competitive conference as this is. And I lived through that. I had very inconsistent quarterback play because of injuries and the like. So I empathize absolutely with Kyle's situation there. And I know, given his love for the game, number one, and for Utah, number two, he'll have his guys ready. I think it should be a whale of a ball game in Salt Lake.
I feel like you have a good handle on all the teams in the Pac-12. Talked about your time at UCLA. Just mentioned Colorado. You also were the head coach at Washington.
Yeah, I've been booed or fired by everybody, Mike.
Mostly cheered, I would hope. I would hope that would be the case. You're only booed here at the Pac-12 Networks, by the way, every Saturday as we walk out onto the set, the host of boos that rain down on you.
Yeah.
The fact that Washington is coming off such a prolific game Does that give them an edge? Because I think from the Washington State perspective, you mentioned the confidence level being at a high for Arizona in the rain. I'd make the same argument for Mike Leach right now.
No question.
With his team.
This is a really interesting game on Friday because you've got two programs that, again, are feeling good about themselves. I would argue that Washington State feels better about themselves than Washington feels about them. Now, Washington's coming off a win over an Oregon State team that was down, obviously. And so for that, they have a chance to go through the 7-win barrier. You know, Sark has been there. This is his fifth year. First year, 5-7. The next three were all 7-6. Much was anticipated for the 2013 season. Starts with the big win, new stadium over Boise State. And we just know, and here they are at 7 wins.
Yeah.
I don't think many people gave Mike Leach a chance to be in this game with a chance to get his 7th win. You know, the win over USC was highly unexpected. And obviously going down to Tucson and winning was a huge win for the Cougars. So this, to me, is a huge ball game for the state of Washington. It's also a huge ball game for the two respective programs. Washington needs to win. They're expected to win. It's a harder position that Sark finds himself in. We don't know if Keith Price will play. I would say if at all possible, he will, given that this is be his last time to play at Husky Stadium. I know it'll be important to him. So if there's any way for him to be on the field, he'll be there. Siler Miles was impressive in week one, although it was against an uninspired Beaver team. So I'm not sure the jury's completely out that he's the absolute beat-all, end-all at quarterback. We'll have to wait and see. But Connor Halliday, on the other side, is coming in this with a lot of confidence. And last year he was sacked 57 times. He and Jeff Toole combined 57 sacks. This year, they're down to 22 sacks. So obviously being able to stand upright, learning the system, getting the ball out of your hands faster, all part of it, some semblance of a running game that was unveiled when they went to Tucson. That, to me, all spells positive for Washington State. The lone negative they have is they went and beat them last year.
Yeah.
So this is not a game that the Huskies are going to overlook. And because of their athleticism, I think they're probably the choice. But it should be a very, very exciting game. And again, you've got two teams that are riding into this game with much to play for.
We end every podcast with two big predictions, one on football, one on Homeland. Are you caught up on Homeland?
We haven't talked Notre Dame-Stanford.
I know.
Who do you like in that one?
Well, based off of what happened last year, I think that there is no question in my mind that
you like revenge motive, huh?
Is there anything better than that? Stephon Taylor, I was just watching the a monitor the other day, and they were showing the play where they said that he was down at the goal line, and it still floors me that was the call in this game. And to give credit to Stanford, not once.
He wasn't down. His forward progress was stopped.
The ruling was I thought that he was...
No, but forward progress was stopped.
I thought the whole controversy was the fact that he was basically on top of guys.
He
was. Never touched.
Which is why he never was down.
Exactly,
but that was my point. But if forward progress is stopped...
Which couldn't have been the case because he kept on moving forward.
Well, that wasn't the ruling on the field. And you and I agree. I thought that they should have given him the touchdown, but it didn't happen. But to me, it's bigger than that. It isn't a revenge motive. Yep. I think these two schools kind of recruit from the same pool. I think they recruit, obviously good students that are elite athletes, and it's a national base for both. And so this has... recruiting bragging rights associated with it. And for Brian Kelly, a win over Stanford 2 years in a row will signal that they're headed in the right direction. Obviously played for a national championship a year ago, not quite at that level this year, but moving in that direction again for that group of athletes. And for Stanford, a win, puts them at that 10 win, a chance to go 11 and then 12 wins, which will put them in rare air as they head forward into the championship game and a chance for another BCS deal. Stanford, 4 straight BCS appearances, hard to imagine.
They have 2 losses on the season, and yet every time they get out and we talk about them heading into a game, I'm always shocked that they can lose. Like, I never feel like Stanford's going to lose a game. It's sort of the best analogy I can come up with when the Patriots were rolling. I mean, we're talking getting to the Super Bowl, and Tom Brady, if they were down in a football game and Tom Brady was stepping onto the field, it never even occurred to me that they were going to lose the game. There was this aura, there was this knack where you just said, hey, they're going to win. Same thing when Jordan was stepping on the floor. Hey, last shot, well, Bulls are going
to
win.
Brian Kelly, to me, the Notre Dame head coach, has been very resourceful. Everett Golson, their quarterback, was ruled ineligible for the season. They played with Tommy Reese, who I think is
25th right now.
Very cerebral, smart player, you know, very accurate thrower. But to me, athlete for athlete, I like Stanford in this game. It's not usually an athlete for athlete deal that says Stanford's the better team. I think it's usually a toughness, a scheme, and a resolute devotion to a way of playing. To me, I think Stanford has all that they need to be successful, especially at home against Notre Dame.
There was one conversation I wanted to get into with you about the Heisman. We'll wait till next week because we're running short on time here. But as I did mention, two big predictions, one on Homeland. You are caught up.
Yes, absolutely. Homeland got a little down and dirty.
Did you feel like it was a little cheesy, though, when they did the – I felt it was Rocky-esque when Brody's training and he's come – and they put like 16 weeks later. I never thought I'd see a transition like
that.
Yeah, but
we didn't hear that. We didn't hear the Rocky theme song.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, what were they going to do? Show you him doing the push-ups and drinking the eggs?
I was looking for Drago. Get me some snow and have him shovel.
No, I mean, the guy was obviously – you know, addicted to painkillers and down and out. And
how about when he starts going at it, when he breaks the chair? Oh my God, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That was sick.
Yeah.
And
it's good disgusting. Someone watched.
disgusting.
Someone was paying close attention.
Yeah, one of those deals. So you said Brody would be back?
Brody is back. And I think we're going to see some wild shenanigans by Brody as he gets back onto U.S. soil.
Oh God. Going to be good. This show is shaping up to be fantastic. But when it comes to football, I don't even know where you're going to go. If I said one, I mean, there's so many, with all these rivalry games, it's hard. Is there one that stands out to you that could surprise people?
You know, I'm going to just go out on a limb.
Well, can I guess?
Yeah, go ahead.
You're taking the Cougs. Like hardcore, even though you think that the talent might be better for Washington.
No, I'm not taking the Cougs.
Okay.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say, Colorado
okay.
is going to beat Utah.
Soundly?
If they win the game, it'll be soundly.
It'll make a noise.
I think Oregon regains form and looks very impressive.
Riley.
Yeah, things went south a little bit, but he's got himself into postseason, or at least a chance for postseason, and hopefully they can right the ship.
We will see you on Saturday morning. 10 a.m. Pacific. That was a weak hit. 10 a.m. Pacific as we get you set for Colorado getting ready to take out Utah here on the Pac-12 networks and then the Territorial Cup at 6:30 p.m. Pacific time. A very meaningful game for those Sun Devils. Always appreciate you listening to us and downloading us at pac-12.com or on iTunes. Candace was sick. Mackenzie helped us out. Juan taking control.
That's so fishy. Sick the day before Thanksgiving. Give me a break.
Plus the
pull this
dude,
finger and it plays jingle bells.
I think Candace bailed on us, maybe. That might have been the case.
I think she did, Mike. Face the facts.
She works hard, though. It's
so you're saying there's a chance.
We will talk to you next week. Enjoy the rivalry games. And, of course, get ready for a big recap. And we'll talk a little Heisman next week on the podcast.
This is the Pac-12 Network's football podcast.